Accession number 27344, wheel 22.
Rob McCandless, reel 22. While you were practising up at Lossiemouth, was there any kind of constraint, either financially or technically or, say, operationally with the squadron, that didn't allow you to get enough practice time in? Or?
Not really. At that particular time, we were certainly given enough by way of practice bombs and practice rockets and practice ammunition for the cannon to do what the syllabus required each student to do. And I think, I can't remember the actual details of number of bombs or anything like that, but it was enough for them to get a good feel for what the job was like. And they would be able to practice more once they joined the squadron anyway. And we were just trying to get them to the point where we had to make up our minds in the squadron whether they were going to be able to do this in a war condition or situation. And there's no doubt that you had to watch each of the pilots who were under training and make up your mind whether they might have been absolutely brilliant academically, but to be honest, that is less important than whether they had the guts to get in and deal with something if there were guns shooting at them. And that needed not so much courage as resolution. Did they have the guts to go and do it? Were they aggressive enough to say, I'll get you, and go for it?
Is there a way of judging that with people? Because I know that you'd had active service and you'd done these things. As an instructor, can you judge that other person easily?
Well, the way I was always looking at it as an instructor was I would look at their results from the range assessing charts, and that would include a whole lot of things giving you information. And if you found that the majority of their follow shot was short of the target, and significantly short of the target, it would indicate to me, almost invariably, that they were dropping too high. They weren't prepared to go to the height they needed to go to drop the weapon accurately. So one has to ask oneself, why are they dropping too high? So then you would get airborne with them in a two-seater aircraft and say, right, take me and we'll do this. And you would watch how they did it and try and make up your mind if this was just a genuine mistake or if it was that they just didn't want to go close enough to the target. And another time, another way it would happen was we used to do air-to-air firing, and this was done on a target towed by a meteor. And we'd go out over the Murray Firth, out over the North Sea, and the meteor would fly up and down, and the students would attack so that they were firing at the towed target. All the bullets they had in their guns were painted a particular colour. So if four went off, you'd have red, white, blue and black, shall we say. So that when the target was dropped back on the airfield, you could go and look at it, and if there were holes in it, you knew which aircraft fired because there was paint around the hole. And you could find out by watching the pilots and seeing how many hits they got, where the hits were, or if they hit it at all, ever. And let's face it, some of them never did hit it. And one had to ask oneself, why are they not hitting it? Because they were following the pattern the same as they should. So once again, you'd go off in a two-seater aircraft and say, right, take me around this. And you'd watch how they did it and find out if they were getting into the harmonisation range for your aircraft. If it was 150 yards, which wouldn't have been unusual, they ought to be at about 150 yards when they were firing. Now, the 150 yards is judged by comparing the target with the sight. You've got a sight with a cross in the middle and a circle around it. And you can judge how close you are to any aircraft if you know the size of the aircraft, and then you compare it with your circle. And when you're going off in a war situation, you would know all this beforehand. You would be briefed by the armament weapons instructor to say what we expect to see are MiG-15s. Now, they're 25 feet long and whatever, and at the right range, they will just fill the circle. That sort of thing, you know. So you begin to get a feel for how it looks within the gun sight. And when you're firing at a towed target, you know the size of the towed target, you know exactly what it should be like at 150 yards in the gun sight. So you're watching what he's doing, and if he's firing too early, then you know he's not ever going to hit anything. Why is he firing too early? Is it misjudgment? Or does he not want to get any closer because he might hit it?
And with that, what would you find? Would there be cases of misjudgment on a regular basis?
Oh,
would it be
more often than not, it was misjudgment. And after flying around a couple of times with them and showing them exactly what they should be doing, they'd be happier about it and get on with it. But I did have one occasion where I couldn't get one of the students to get close enough. And he was a gentle man altogether, and he just wasn't sufficiently aggressive to try. So we took him off frontline flying and gave him another job.
The aggression or resolution, is that almost, because obviously he's come a long, long way to be trained to get to that level. Is it almost something until you're at that level that you can't judge with people?
I don't know. I was never involved with instructing earlier than the operational instruction, so I couldn't tell you. I think it would be difficult to pick it out earlier on, but I don't know. I can't really imagine a time until you come on to operational training, such as the torpedo, dive bombing, all that, when they really are trying to get to the target, that you begin to see whether they've got the determination to get there. So I think it's only at that time you begin to know. And you know, it is, as you say, an amazing thing. The service has spent a lot of money training them up to this standard, and then to say, sorry, you'll have to go and do some other type of flying. Still, you know, it's not entirely wasted, but it's not exactly what we hope for. You see, thinking back, of 200 on our course who joined up to fly, I suppose the number that actually did get into a frontline squadron would be less than 50. And after the war, I mean, then you're letting anybody in, even me. But after the war, we were more safety conscious. And we were trying to protect pilots against their own, I don't know, inexperience, inability, whatever it was. And sometimes they were dropped on occasions when in wartime they'd have been allowed to continue. But the number who get to a frontline squadron is really quite low compared with the number who volunteer. Of course, there's about a quarter disappear before they ever start flying, simply because they haven't got coordination or whatever it is.
Seems a very interesting combination of skills needed to actually deliver that weapon to that target.
Oh, yes. It does take a long time to get somebody up to the state where they are good enough to be fairly certain of delivering a bomb or a rocket or strafing on the target or within a distance from the target where the explosion will affect it. It does take a long time.
How much did you enjoy the experience of instructing?
Oh, very much. Well, I enjoyed all my flying, quite honestly. I hate being instructed. But as an instructor, we were usually leading four aircraft and watching what they were doing in the air and telling them what they were doing and just trying to make sure that they were beginning to develop the right techniques. And if, as I said, on odd occasions, when you pinpointed a particular problem, then you would fly with them in a two-seater aircraft, usually a vampire trainer, because you could still fire guns and drop bombs and all that sort of thing from it. So you'd fly in a vampire trainer with them and find out what it was they were doing and if you could pinpoint what it was they were doing wrong. And generally speaking, you could just say, well, if you did it this way or if you did it that way or if you got a little bit closer or what's the instrument here, you could really get them to the point where after a few dives or whatever, they would gradually get to the point where they were doing it, shall we say, adequately. Not everyone was good. I mean, it applies in all walks of life. Not everyone is good. Some are excellent. But we tried not to take into a frontline squadron those that were sadly below average. We would really only want what would be termed average or better than average in the squadron.
But they would be assigned, the ones who didn't make the grade, they would be assigned to what type of flying within the fleet aero?
Well, for example, they could have gone and flown the Gannet, the airborne early warning aircraft. Or they could have gone and flown in the aircraft that train the observers.
Could they have retrained as helicopter pilots?
Yes, oh yes. Well, once the helicopters came in, but there was always a flying job they could do. The whole of their flying training wasn't lost. But of course, generally speaking, if they were taken off the operational work and going on to second line work, they were very disappointed. I do know of one or two who were so disappointed that they gave up flying altogether and went to do something else, perhaps went to be a seaman. And I think they probably enjoyed it. Well, during the war, I can remember particularly one friend of mine who was failed in elementary flying training, and he was bitterly disappointed. And I kept in touch with him for a while, and he went and became an MTB captain. And he said it was great. He thoroughly enjoyed it. Again, he had a fast machine, and he was able to go and do something. And that was really what he wanted to do. He didn't want to be left not taking part in the war.
Can you tell me about the Vampire Trainer as an aircraft?
Oh, I hated it. It was quite a good aircraft, and it had a Goblin jet engine. Not a very powerful one, but it was still a bit faster than the Sea Fury. But it was side-by-side seats for a trainer. And with two people of my build, and I'm not all that big, it really was very awkward. It was claustrophobic in the cockpit. And there was always a bit of a tussle trying to find your own straps to make sure that you were strapped to your seat and not to his seat. And that was important if one was going to eject. So it really wasn't comfortable, and your arms were really pressing very close together, and it just was not comfortable in any way. And I just felt claustrophobic in it, in a similar way as I had in a CFAR. Just the canopy was too close to my head, and I was too close to the side on one side and to the man on the other side. I like just a little bit more room to move my arms. It was a good aircraft to fly. And we, all the jet trained pilots, did their instrument flying in a Vampire Trainer. We didn't have, well, we did have some Meteor 7s in the fleet air arm, but very few, and they only did target towing. But all the instrument flying was done in Vampires. And we used to get instrument flying checks once a year. We used to have a small group of instructors, we used to call them the trappers, who would fly around all the naval air stations and make sure that every pilot on each station was tested once a year in instrument flying. And the instrument flying was a particular pattern that you had to fly. You would have to take off on instruments, climb to a certain height, 10,000 feet I think it was, and you would have to do level turns, climbing turns, descending turns, and some other manoeuvres like that, and do them all very precisely. So that if you were doing a rate one turn, you went round through 360 degrees in 2 minutes, 180 degrees in 1 minute. And if you were doing a rate two turn, then you had to do the turn at the right rate of turn, go round the right number of degrees in the right number of seconds. Climbing, speed is important. Descending, speed is important. And you had to fly so that the speed was within 5 knots of the designated speed. And we all got used to flying this pattern, but it didn't mean we were all good at it. But we were all tested so that we were adequate, so that their lordships knew that everyone was able to fly in cloud and descend through cloud and land with ground-controlled approach. So the Vampire Trainer did serve a very useful purpose, but I just didn't like flying in it.
You mentioned one thing there. That it would have been a problem if you wanted to eject. At that stage, had ejection seats been introduced?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Was that with the jet aircraft?
Yes, the early Meteors didn't have jets, but the later ones were modified and did have jet seats. I don't know if you've ever seen the picture of a Meteor 7 going down the runway and the experiment of a man being ejected out of the back seat while the wheels were still on the ground. Well, that was a Meteor 7. So all the Meteor 7s ultimately had ejection seats. All the Seahawks had ejection seats, and all the Vampires had ejection seats.
Did you have any training on that? How to operate?
Yes. What we used to have was a ramp. And there was an ejector seat fitted on the bottom of the ramp. And you were strapped in the seat. And then you were shown how to work the ejector seat. And in the early days, it was a matter of catching a D-ring above your head and pulling it down over your face. And you were actually pulling a blind down so that the wind speed as you went out, you were protected against it. So as you pulled it down, the last inch or two fired the ejector seat and you went whoosh up the ramp. But it was only sort of half power ejection. There was no danger of having a back injury or anything like that. But it was an interesting exercise to do. And we all did it at least once.
And how does the ejector seat work? It obviously it fires you out of the cockpit, but are you attached to the seat all that time when you make your descent?
No. The thing is that, if you take a Seahawk for example, when you first pull or fire in the Seahawk, it came up from between your legs, so you still had your face exposed or could have it exposed. Anyway, when you first pulled the lever, the first thing that happened was the canopy disappeared. And then, a split second later, the whole seat was fired out with an explosive charge. It was fired out of the aircraft so that you were clear of the tail and everything else. And then there was a drogue released from the seat that you're sitting in. And that would stabilise you so that you were floating down on this tiny drogue, but you weren't tumbling. And when you got to that stage, your harness was automatically released from the seat and you fell out of the seat. and then you pulled your own parachute in order to float down on your parachute.
So you would sit in the ejection seat?
That was in those days. Nowadays, even the parachute is automatic.
But would you sit on your parachute?
Oh, yes.
In the ejector seat?
Yeah, there's a bucket seat, as they call it, which is quite deep. And you had your parachute and a dinghy, an inflatable dinghy, which was your cushion that you sat on. So that if you're going to eject into the sea, at least you got there with a dinghy as well. But it was all together in the seat, and you could get out really very quickly.
And can I ask you sort of a couple of things there? Had your headgear changed by the time you were flying in the Seagull?
Yeah, when we were flying in the Barracudas, we had leather helmets in the cold climates and a canvas helmet. You've probably seen them plenty of times in the tropics. And I suppose we just got used to them. And then they brought in what they called the bone dome. And this was a fiberglass helmet. And it was made to fit over a canvas helmet. So you put on, blue actually, you put on a blue canvas helmet which had earphones in it. And then you would fit the bone dome over the top. And the bone dome was shaped so that it would fit fairly closely to your head and over the earphones. And the bone dome had some form of padding inside so that you weren't hitting the ground directly with your head the other side of the bone dome, as it were. And it took us a long time to get used to those. They had so many different shapes and sizes while they were experimenting to begin with. And out in Korea, we had the normal leather helmets. But when we came back to this country, then we started to find we were getting the bone domes. Then the bone dome continued to develop until you got to the stage where you were putting the inner helmet and the outer helmet on together. And you had a small lead from the bone dome, which would plug in to the radio in the aircraft. And that was a lead which just hung down behind you here, so that when the seat was shot out, that just pulled out automatically as you went. So there was no tug on your head. The bone domes did develop so that although we had goggles to begin with, they were not successful because the bone dome was such that it was probably about an inch off your face either side. And with the goggles coming an inch off your face there, they were sort of flapping around in front and they weren't very useful. So they did develop a visor which ran in a small track which ran from the forehead over the middle of the helmet going around towards the back. And the visor was usually either coloured or polarised so that it would act as a sun glare thing as well, you know, like sunglasses. And it had a little catch on it, and the visor had a little catch on it, so you could fix it in any position on the track. So you could have it down so that it was just above your eyes, but high enough to act as a sun guard, or you could put it right down to protect your face entirely, whichever way you preferred to do it. And they were very good, very effective, and we all got used to using it.
And what about flying clothing? Had that changed over from your time in the Second World War to when you were flying?
Oh, yes. Well, it was developing all the time. I first started off and we were flying from ship to shore in the Orkneys, we flew in our normal uniforms, collar and tie, and some even wore their greatcoats. God, we were a motley crew then. But then we had canvas overalls, which were good hard-wearing overalls, and the soft boots that we talked about earlier on. And then the soft boots disappeared, and we had harder black boots which had a short leg on them up the calf, and those were designed so that you could tear the leg off and wear the bottom part as a shoe, so that if you were ashore, or if you had to bail out over enemy territory, at least you weren't clumping around in flying boots, you were clumping around in shoes. That was the intention anyway. And then gradually we got to the point where if we were flying over the sea, we used to have to wear immersion suits. And this was put on top of your underwear, basically. And it was material which allowed the air to breathe through it so you could sweat, and it was comfortable enough. But in the water, the fibre swelled and kept the water out to a fair extent anyway. So the trousers of this had the boots welded on the bottom of the leg, and you would pull them up and put the braces over your shoulders, and round the waist there was a band of rubber about, I suppose, a foot wide, of quite soft rubber. And you used to just take that and keep it down like an apron all round, and just keep it there while you put the top half on. So the top half, you had to pull it over your head, and it was difficult because round your neck was a watertight seal. And that was of fairly soft rubber, but it was quite effective in acting as a watertight seal. On the wrists were watertight seals with the same rubber. So then you'd pull down the blouse, and on the bottom of the blouse was another band of rubber about a foot wide, similar to that that was on the trousers. So you would pull that down and put it over the trouser band and then roll both of them up together. And by rolling it up, you got a watertight seal around your waist as well. So that was the immersion suit. We used to wear those any time we were flying in the winter over water. I never had to use one, but we used to practice in our safety equipment drills wearing them in the water, and they were quite effective. So we were all content that we would be saved from a fate worse than death. But then, of course, there were continuing developments even after that. And I can remember when I went to fly in Hunters, I was given a pair of what they called G pants. And these were like corsets, which fitted very snugly over your lower limbs and up over to your waist. And they were connected to an air system which would give you compressed air under pressure. And if the compressed air was turned on, it would blow into a large number of small tubes throughout the corset and gradually increase pressure on your legs and your lower body. And the control for this compressed air was through the amount of G that you were pulling on the aircraft. So the more G, the more compressed air, so the more pressure on your lower limbs, and that stopped the blood draining from your upper body into your lower body, and you didn't black out quite so quickly. And I think that's probably the most modern of the flying suits that I wore, but then I stopped flying in the 1960s, and I expect it's developed tremendously since then.